I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. In a closely watched race that could tip the U.S. Senate, Democrat John Fetterman beat Republican Mehmet Oz in a hard-fought contest here in Pennsylvania. Fetterman is still recovering from a stroke he suffered a few days before the spring primary. He trolled Oz relentlessly for being from New Jersey. Here's what Fetterman told his supporters.
We launched this campaign almost 2 years ago. And we had our slogan. It's on every one of those signs right now. Every county, every vote. Every county, every vote. And that's exactly what happened. We jammed them up. We held the line. I never expected that we were going to turn these red counties blue, but we did what we needed to do, and we had that conversation across every one of those counties. And tonight, that's why I'll be the next U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania.
Attorney General Democrat Josh Shapiro had a much easier time defeating his Republican opponent Doug Mastriano, an election denier who was at the Capitol on January 6 and held extreme positions on a number of key issues, including on abortion, once saying that a woman who violates a ban should be charged with murder. Here's Shapiro last night.
Tonight, you, the good people of Pennsylvania, you won. Opportunity won. A woman's right to choose won. The right to organize here in Pennsylvania, that won. Your right to vote won. And in the face of all the lies and the conspiracies and baseless claims, also ensured tonight that truth won right here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Today on Radio Times, what happened in Pennsylvania and what we know about some other key races. And joining us, Katie Meyer, government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA. She's with me here in our Philadelphia studio. Katie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Colby Itkowitz, and she's national politics reporter for The Washington Post, was born here in Pennsylvania. And Colby Itkowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we always want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know if you voted last night, who you voted for, and what you think about the victories, at least so far. Well, let's talk about these two campaigns, these two candidates, two very different people, Katie Meyer, when we're talking about John Fetterman, and Josh Shapiro. How is Shapiro able to beat Doug Mastriano, his chosen candidate to run against?
Yes, and when you say that, I mean, yeah, and late in the primary, Shapiro ran ads that were very broadly interpreted as being pro-Mastriano winning the GOP primary, which was controversial at the time, but he has beaten Mastriano extremely handily. And I think there's a couple factors that should be mentioned here. One is that candidates really matter. So we like to talk in politics about, like, political truths, about how a midterm after a presidential election is usually bad for that new president's party, which, you know, is often true, but can really be overshadowed if there's, like, an unusual candidate, which Doug Mastriano really, really was. So I would say two things about that. Mastriano ran a very poorly funded campaign. He didn't get very much support from within his own party, from the powerful people you usually see lining up behind a major candidate. And he was also a very extreme candidate. I mean, he had said during a debate that he wanted to ban all abortion without exceptions, and that was a refrain throughout. And then you do have Shapiro, who in Pennsylvania circles is really, really known as someone who can run ahead of other Democratic candidates across the state, who is good at bringing together these coalitions that don't always coalesce. So a kind of a two-pronged factor, but yeah, can't stress enough how decisive this race was.
And Shapiro sounds just like Barack Obama.
We were just talking about this.
Debbie Builder noticed that, but you said, Katie, he sounded that way for a while.
So this is something, I'm glad that people are realizing this, because I've been saying this for years. Yeah, he does sound, his cadences are very Obama-esque, I think.
Let me get you, Colby, to talk about then the Fetterman win, which was obviously a much closer race. How was Fetterman able to pull it out?
Yeah, and you know, I'm not maybe as surprised as some people by Fetterman's victory last night. You know, he had a similar strategy to Shapiro, which was to go talk to voters in places where Democrats don't always go. And so he really tried to siphon off voters in Trump-won counties. And he ran well ahead of Joe Biden in many of those counties last night. Remember, Joe Biden won the state. And so that allowed Fetterman to win the state by an even larger margin. He really appealed to people by, you know, it's become something of a cliche to say this now, but like the way he dresses, the way he talks.
People like that, right?
They like it. They feel like he is relatable, that he really cares about them, that he can get them. And you couldn't have had more of a stark opposite in Dr. Oz, someone who was not from the state, who is a very wealthy celebrity, someone who Fetterman just hammered home this idea that this man does not understand your pain. And it worked.
How much do you think the debate, and there was one debate between Oz and Fetterman, Katie, how much do you think that made a difference or not? Obviously, many people had already voted by then.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple ways we can measure whether it made a difference. One is polling, just comparing polls before and after the debate. And what we saw was not a hugely measurable or really just any big difference in the polls for Fetterman post and pre and post debate. So that was one thing we could look at. I mean, I think the fact that the campaign waited so long, they were able to say, yes, he's debating, we're not keeping him from the public, but then waited until, you know, voters had already started casting mail ballots to have this debate. People's minds were more or less made up. There had been a ton of rhetoric that was, you know, locking people's opinions down before the debate happened. And so I do think you get less sway when you have it so late in the game. So they made a couple, you know, at the time, you know, there's always a lot of backbenching, controversial calls on how to handle that. Obviously, he had been affected by the stroke. That's a really, really tough atmosphere for somebody struggling with the kind of, you know, sensory processing stuff that Fetterman has. But, you know, I would say that the campaign was vindicated on that decision.
Well, Colby, they seem to use it to humanize the candidate.
Absolutely. It was a strategy that they employed pretty early on after John Fetterman had his stroke a couple of days before the primary, which was to make that part of his relatable appeal. He would stand up at rallies and say, you know, raise your hand if you've ever had a serious health crisis. Raise your hand if someone you love, a spouse, a parent, a child, has had a serious health crisis. And by the end of it, everyone's hands would be in the air because everybody knows someone who's been sick. And he would say something to the effect of, like, you know, I'm glad that you don't have a doctor in your, I hope you don't have a doctor in your life mocking your recovery. Wow. Or your loved one's recovery the way that I do in my life. And, you know, the efforts by the Republicans to make the stroke a deficit, to make it seem like he was not in shape to be a senator, really backfired. It brought up all these questions about ableism and disability and whether someone with a disability can run for an office like the Senate. And at the end of the day, people did not see the stroke as they saw it as a reason to vote for him, even not a reason to oppose him.
Very interesting. Well, let me ask you, Katie, about Mehmet Oz and Doug Mastriano. These were two Trump-backed candidates, and mm-hmm. the fact that they both lost here in Pennsylvania, which is often described as a purple state. I don't know how purple it still is, but nonetheless, what does that say? What's the significance, do you think?
I think it is significant. I mean, we're in a situation where Trump is maybe on the verge of announcing another presidential run, and so it's a very useful data point to look at how his endorsed candidates do. And so obviously, in Mehmet Oz and Doug Mastriano, we have very different candidates, both with like their own sort of cocktail of negatives that I think did not help them in this race. But Mastriano is sort of a true believer, somebody who is very, very enmeshed in this idea that the 2020 election was somehow fraudulent. It was not, of course. And then you had Oz, who I think, you know, more mainstream Republicans, or whatever you want to define mainstream as, saw him as somebody who could probably do okay, for instance, in the Philadelphia suburbs, not lose too many votes there, who could come off as sort of a run to the middle guy. And so, again, you saw them, I think, not do well for maybe kind of different reasons. Mm-hmm. Oz wasn't able to convince voters that he was really a Pennsylvanian, wasn't able to relate to people. At least that's what I heard from a lot of voters that I talked to. Whereas Mastriano, I just think, was seen as way too extreme. So, I think they did badly for slightly different reasons. But in both cases, Trump was central to their candidacies. And yeah, absolutely. That's going to reflect on him.
And Colby, I know looking across the country, not all the results are in, but I'm wondering whether when you look at the Trump-backed candidates, I think there were something like 370 Republicans running for office who either doubted the 2020 election or rejected it outright. Do we know how they fared and if that says anything about former President Trump?
You know, former President Trump did not have a great night last night. A lot of the candidates that he stood up, that he, really vouched for, like Mehmet Oz, came up short. There will be winners of races who deny the results of the 2020 election. But overall, I mean, the margins in which the Republicans will likely win the House are going to be small. The Democrats still have a chance to hold on to the Senate. Their candidates are looking good in Arizona and Nevada, which are still too close to call. Georgia might go to a runoff. And so this whole conversation that was been had over the last several weeks about this, you know, this big red wave, this red tsunami that was coming, just didn't materialize. And I think part of that is, to Katie's point, a lot of it is candidate specific as well. I mean, it's hard to kind of take the country and make these broad generalizations about which way the winds are turning. At the end of the day, there was no other candidate like Mehmet Oz anywhere else in the country. There was few like Doug Mastriano. And to that end, few like John Fetterman and Josh Shapiro. When we look at this, we might want to, in future elections, I think, maybe start thinking more about the states themselves and the candidate quality and kind of what voters want in these individual states instead of trying to take on this big national mood.
Sure. And Katie, we're almost up in a break here. I mean, maybe it's time to retire some of these pundits.
I'm always
not naming names here.
I'm always pro-retiring a couple pundits every election. I think Colby's absolutely right. Like, it's just, there is no one-size-fits-all. Candidates really, really matter. And I think if there's any lesson out of this race, it's that.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation, making sense of last night's election here in Pennsylvania. That's Katie Meyer. She is government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA. Used to be our politics reporter here at WHYY. Colby Itkowitz is with us as well, and she's national politics reporter for The Washington Post. And as you probably know by now, John Fetterman, Josh Shapiro were able to beat their candidate, or their opponents, I should say, for the U.S. Senate and also for governorship here in Pennsylvania. We always want to hear from you, especially those of you who care about politics and our political system. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about what the Fetterman and Shapiro victories in Pennsylvania say about voters in the Commonwealth. We'll also be talking about the results of the midterm elections, what it says about the state of our political system, and what lies ahead. And again, talking with reporters Katie Meyer and Colby Itkowitz. Katie, let's talk about some of the lesser-known candidates here in Pennsylvania, the more down-ballot races.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There we go. Absolutely, Marty. Yeah. So one of the things that I'm watching right now, now that we have results in the two big races, is the State House. And this is a chamber of Pennsylvania's government that's been controlled by Republicans for more than a decade. And it is within striking distance for Democrats to take control, which would be a really big deal. Wow. Now, we have – I'm going to caveat this until it doesn't mean anything. But, like, we don't have all the results yet. Mail ballots are still being counted, especially in the big Philadelphia counties, which is where some of these key races are. And so we can see this stuff change. But I think – the takeaway just now, as we don't know things yet, is that Democrats I talked to before the election were kind of like hedging their bets about this year. They thought it was going to be a good year for them. There's a new legislative map in place in both the House and the Senate. There was redistricting this year. And that put Democrats in a much better position than they've been in for a decade. Now, what that was going to do for them, nobody knew. People thought that maybe the chamber would flip in 2024. That was considered a better year for Democrats. Nobody wanted to say if it could really happen this year, but it's possible this year. And I should also say, along with counting ballots, there are a couple major court cases that are in federal court right now. This was mostly Democratic organizations contesting a rule that Pennsylvania couldn't count undated or misstated mail ballots. These are really, really close races, so those ballots could end up being important. So we might see litigation in one direction or another, people, you know, advocating to count or not count them.
Well, and I wonder, Colby, sort of looking even at other races in other states that you have been covering, whether you see sort of similar fights happening in other parts of the country.
Yeah, and I think that you know, the Democrats are performing better in places all over the country. I know that I just said that we shouldn't take these kind of wide sweeping looks at results, but I think what we haven't talked about yet is abortion and the massive role that I think the decision to strike down Roe v. Wade played in turning out Democratic voters yesterday. People thought that maybe there had been, you know, a peak of interest right when it happened and that had fallen off, but they underestimated the fact that women and men that I talked to all around Philadelphia and the Philadelphia suburbs cited it as the reason why they showed up.
You mentioned the suburbs, and how key do you think this, I mean, I realize votes are still being counted, but Colby, how key do you think voters in the suburbs are when it comes to especially closely divided races?
They're always, especially in Pennsylvania. I mean, the population, it's so vote rich around Philadelphia. Those voters tend to be very independent minded. I spent some time in a diner in Delaware County a few weekends ago and happened to just talk to all registered Republicans and all registered Republicans that were voting for Shapiro and several that were leaning towards voting for Fetterman. And so you have that kind of independent-minded voting streak in the Philadelphia suburbs. It's super unique to this area. And so couple that with the fact that Fetterman and Shapiro ran ahead of typical Democratic norms in some of these more conservative Trump-won counties, and that together was a recipe for success.
You talk about the mail-in ballots, which, of course, many, many people in Pennsylvania, Katie, use the mail-in ballots. But there was in 2020 this 4 or 5 day sort of void when the results of the presidential election had not been determined yet. It seems like the system worked a little better this time.
Yeah, and there's a couple reasons why. First, 2020, that was the first really big election where no excuse mail voting had been used in Pennsylvania. And it was a really, really big election with super high turnout, and counties were getting used to the process. And so it just took longer. People didn't want to make mistakes. This year, we've had a couple more elections since then. There have been three kind of more off-year elections, and counties have improved their processes. Some of them have gotten better equipment to process mail ballots. And, you know, another big factor is that the state legislature, while they didn't pass legislation that counties have been asking for to let them start counting mail ballots earlier, which would make a huge difference, they did get an infusion of money from the state to fund election processes. And they got a new requirement from the state that they count continuously, which was a requirement that they do that in order to get the money. And so that is something that, you know, forced counties to bring on more staff to keep people much later than they would have otherwise and get those mail ballots tabulated as quickly as possible. And we did see that. Now, there's some, you know, always hiccups. Philadelphia just yesterday changed its vote counting process because they were in this litigation with a Republican group. And basically, they ended up just conceding and saying, OK, we'll do this extra double check on double voting that you wanted us to do. But, yeah, you know, across the state, generally, we did not see the kind of lags that we saw in 2020.
And Colby, Austin Davis, now the first African-American lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania, he obviously was the candidate along with Josh Shapiro. But, you know, that's a historic win for racial equality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, Colby. Go ahead, Colby.
So sorry, I don't know what happened.
I think it was just one of those scary pauses on radio. Go ahead, Colby. No, that's okay. Talking about Austin Davis.
Yeah, and I think you know, he and Shapiro talked a lot yesterday. I saw him at a event in Philadelphia with, you know, Black political leaders, and talked a lot about their partnership and how he really looked forward to, you know, him and Austin Davis kind of being a real team, and Austin Davis elevating the role of lieutenant governor. And so I think we should expect, you know, big things from him as, you know, a potential rising star in the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania.
Well, that's interesting. And Katie, last weekend, Obama was here. Even Biden came to Pennsylvania, pulling out the big guns for the Democratic Party.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And again, I think you can't stress enough, both parties did this to some extent, but the Democrats felt more confident in their candidates, frankly, than Republicans did. We mentioned that Mastriano wasn't getting a lot of firepower from the party, apart from appearances by Donald Trump. And so, absolutely, you saw that. You know, there's a truism in politics. If nothing else, you know, you're going to get major figures in Pennsylvania right before a big election. They just, you know,
it's
they can't stay away. They just come here. And Marty, before we wrap up, I did want to know one more thing. Just, you know, it wasn't just the Philadelphia suburbs, I would say, that really shaped this swing for Democrats, this big result that we saw. You know, you see a lot of smaller counties where the suburbs also seemed to trend blue. So Lancaster County, for instance, Josh Shapiro came within 2 points with the votes that we have now. It looks like 2 points of actually winning that county, which is
unusual.
Really unusual for Pennsylvania. So another just data point for you to think about.
And Colby, I mean, no election is perfect, but there were certainly, you know, predictions that there were going to be all sorts of irregularities and harassment. At least as we understand so far, did things go pretty smoothly in the Commonwealth?
It certainly seems like things went smoothly yesterday. We knew the results of the election, the actual night of the election, and so that was
huge.
Something people weren't sure if we would actually know who won. They were pretty certain we would know the governor's race, but there was all this talk about the Senate race not being known for days and days. And so, yeah, all the kind of fear around how badly yesterday could have gone certainly didn't materialize, at least in Pennsylvania.
Here's a comment from James. I voted for Fetterman and Shapiro to bring some sanity back into the electoral system and into democracy. Katie, I know you had a long night. I'm sure, Colby, you did as well. So what do you be looking for as things wrap up here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I'm looking at the State House. I think it'll be, you know, if you're a Pennsylvanian, who controls the State House has an enormous amount to do, especially now that there's, you know, another Democratic governor, has an enormous amount to do with what legislation gets passed. And so we will see what happens there. Again, more ballots to count.
Well, and I think there's one thing we learned, Colby, just about the importance of local and statewide races when it comes even to national politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's up and down the ballot, right? So, I mean, I think Josh Shapiro, obviously being a really strong candidate at the top of the ticket, you know, really helped propel other Democratic candidates down ballot. But you also need stronger down ballot candidates as well that people are excited to come out and vote for. And so, you know, we often think about elections as top down, but, you know, it's important to also think about it from bottom up.
Absolutely. Colby Yudkowitz, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she is national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Katie Meyer, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
And she is government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA. Well, while votes are still being counted, the expected red wave of Republicans, election deniers, and Trump supporters did not have the night that had been predicted. We still don't have the final tallies for the House and Senate seats, but it's clear that Democrats did not have the shellacking they experienced in 2010. And while inflation and the economy were on people's minds, so was Roe and the Dobbs decision that took away a constitutionally protected right to an abortion. It's estimated that some $16 billion was spent on all the campaigns, much of it for TV ads. So what to make of the midterm elections and our political process? What does it portend for the next election that is just on the horizon? And joining us is Jesse Wegman. He's on the editorial board of The New York Times, author of a book that came out a while ago, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times, and it's titled Let the People Pick the President, about abolishing the Electoral College. And Jesse Wegman, joining us by Skype. Thanks for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you. We're talking about our election and our electoral system. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We just spent the first half hour talking about Pennsylvania for all the obvious reasons, but Jesse, I'd be curious about your takeaway about what happened, especially when it came to the U.S. Senate race here in Pennsylvania, also the race for governor.
Sure. You know, well, let me say this. I mean, presidential elections and presidential election years, obviously, you know, they get so much of our attention, and understandably so. You know, I wrote a whole book about the way we elect presidents. But midterms are just as consequential to American politics. Midterms matter. You know, and we can go back the last four of them, the 2010 midterms, in Barack Obama's first term, ushered in this sweeping, that was a real red wave, yeah. And gave Republicans control of state houses and governorships around the country, which led to our, you know, current state of gerrymandering. The 2014 midterms gave Republicans the Senate, and that led to their ability to block Barack Obama's last Supreme Court pick and ultimately, as we know, to the to overturning of Roe v. Wade. The 2018 midterms allowed Democrats to actually hold Donald Trump accountable through impeachment. And now here we have today's midterms, which, have led to, I think, a pretty remarkable and resounding reaffirmation of basic democratic principles. And I just think we can't ever underestimate the importance of these elections alongside the normal four-year presidential elections.
Are you saying our democracy is in better shape than predicted? Not that the Democrats won, but that there was a big voter turnout and people seem to be voting on the issues that they care about.
Exactly. I mean, I'm always heartened when I see more people turning out to vote. And it's not, obviously, I have my own political predilections,
but don't we all?
You know, but I'm thrilled to see people of all political persuasions coming out and voting. I just think, you know, representative democracy works better when the people themselves are more involved and care more. And we've been seeing that. I mentioned that 2014 midterms. Those were sort of, you know, astonishingly, embarrassingly low turnout numbers that year. I think it was in the high 30s around the country. Which you know, just should never fall that low. But ever since then, it's been going up steadily. And I think yesterday was just more proof of that, not just, nationally, but specifically among young voters. I think seeing young voters come out in the numbers that they came out, and we're still getting that data, seeing the response to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which I think obviously energized voters across the political spectrum. I think every single, if I'm not mistaken, every single measure that dealt with the question of abortion rights, either expanding or contracting them, was in the direction of protecting abortion and protecting abortion rights, or not further cutting back on them. So I think that's something we really need to pay attention to in the future. Is when people come out and vote, you have a more accurate representation of what people want. It sounds obvious, but it's very true.
Well, let me ask you about election deniers. And I think it was your paper that said there were 370 Republican candidates who either denied the 2020 election or certainly shed some doubt on those results. Now, some of them did win, but there are a lot of close races where we don't know the winner or not. Or in the case of Mastriano and Oz here in Pennsylvania, who lost. Does that say that this lie about election denying can be put to rest?
It certainly can't be put to rest. This is, you know, the election denialism that, I think Donald Trump, exacerbated over the last 6 years has really become a sickness on the right. And it's a poison, really, to Democratic self-rule when an entire party refuses to accept the outcome of elections that it doesn't win. But as you say, a lot of the, you know, torchbearers for that position lost last night. And I think that's something that all Americans who want their votes counted and who want a basic representative democracy to function as it's supposed to can take solace in. I think almost all of the gubernatorial candidates who ran on a platform of denialism have lost. Most of the secretaries of state candidates, same thing. And I think it's something that we're just going to have to keep pushing back against, because regardless of your party, you need to acknowledge that a democracy can only survive when losers accept the outcome as legitimate, right? And, you know, I think that's why Tim Ryan's concession speech was just so powerful. You know, I mean, you know, yes, everybody's supposed to concede, and that's great. But Tim Ryan made, you know, he made an art out of it. He said, you know, it is my privilege to concede. Just to call it a privilege is such an important thing to do, and such a powerful message, I think, to send, which is that conceding is not only about losing. It is about reaffirming the system of government that we live under, and reaffirming that, you know, every few years we go out to the polls, people vote, they disagree about whom they want to represent them. One side wins, the other side loses. Things change over the years, and then the, you know, the winners and losers change sides. And that's just how democracy works. And, this what's developed over these last few years, this refusal to accept any loss as legitimate, is something that's just it cannot coexist with a functioning, self-governing society. So, yes, I feel really heartened by the results last night. And I hope that this continues into 2024. Whoever is on the ballot, both for the presidency and for the races down ballot, I'm really hoping that, you know, as few of them as possible are challenging the results of elections that they lose.
In fact, we have to take a very short break, and we have that Tim Ryan concession speech queued up, which we will play after this very short break. But just a quick re-identification, that's Jesse Wegman. He's on the editorial board of The New York Times. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Let the People Pick the President, about abolishing the Electoral College system. We are talking about this year's midterm election results, what they mean, what they don't mean. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Jesse Wegman, who's a member of the editorial board of the New York Times, about what the results of the midterm election say about the state of our political system and what lies ahead. And we were talking about Ohio Democratic candidate Tim Ryan's concession speech last night. And this was after he lost to J.D. Vance for the open U.S. Senate seat. And here's just a bit of what he said.
I have a privilege right now, a privilege, as someone who was the Democratic nominee. I have the privilege to concede this race to J.D. Vance, because the way this country operates is that when you lose an election, you concede. And you respect... You respect the will of the people, right? We can't have a system where if you win, it's a legitimate election, and if you lose, someone stole it. That is not how we can move forward in the United States.
And Jesse, I mean, it is inspiring, but it is the way our system is supposed to work, which I think tells us something about the state that we're in.
Well, you know, if we've learned anything from the last 6 years, is that democracy is not self-perpetuating. It requires constant care and feeding. It requires citizens being reminded of what is expected of them. And, you know, I that speech is so important. I you know what it reflects back to me. the last speech of such a type, I think, that was on December 13th, 2000, and which I still consider one of the most important moments in modern American history, if not all of American history. And that was the night that Al Gore conceded the 2000 presidential election to George W. Bush following the Supreme Court's final decision shutting down the recount in Florida. And, you know, Al Gore said at the time, I disagree with this decision, and yet I respect it. And I think that was just such a powerful and meaningful moment for American democracy to acknowledge that we have a rule of law and that courts are the final arbiters of some of our most contested disputes, mm-hmm. and that their rulings have to be respected even when we don't disagree with them, even when it means we lose an election. And to set that example in one of the most, you know, closely fought controversial elections of the modern age was, I think, something that, you know, that's Al Gore's legacy. And I think this may be Tim Ryan's. You know, obviously the stakes in his race were lower, but nevertheless, the message he was sending was so important. This message that all of us need to respect the outcome of elections. And if we lose, regroup and try again.
We are talking, obviously, almost 2 years after the insurrection, the Trump-led insurrection. I don't mean physically led, but certainly psychologically and politically led by Donald Trump to repudiate the results of the 2020 election. Taking Tim Ryan's, you know, inspiring words, or even thinking about Al Gore, you know, is the pen mightier than the sword?
Well, yeah, and here's what I'll say. I mean, that's throughout human history, I don't think the results are always so good. But here's what I'll say is, you know, look, Donald Trump, you know, is Donald Trump, and he will always be Donald Trump. And I think I'm hoping that enough people on the right could see that last night and could get frustrated by the results to push him out of the picture. I don't know if that will happen yet, but, you know, I mean, look, the problem with a representative democracy is you can't run elections when people refuse to accept the results. That's the bottom line. And Donald Trump, you know, is at the forefront of that movement right now. But he has created this entire movement behind him of people who believe, you know, either genuinely or instrumentally believe that there's just no way they can win. You know, they say the other side is cheating, it's illegitimate. And in that sense, I actually think if the results right now hold up, you know, if the Democrats hold the Senate and Republicans take back the House, you know, as a policy matter, I'm not thrilled personally. I think a Democratic-led House could result in a lot better policy for the country and would prevent a lot of, I think, the shenanigans that Republicans will undertake if they do take control. But as a matter of sort of a illustration of how democracy works, I think there's actually a silver lining, which is that it shows Republicans, reasonable Republicans, of whom I think there are still many around the country, that they can win elections, and they can even win houses of Congress in the same elections that Democrats win too. So it shows both sides you can win and still lose some of your races. It's not all or nothing, which is, I think, how so many people have come to portray it in recent years, and which I think is such an existential threat to the country as a whole. So when you can feel like, oh, we win some, we lose some, which is literally what appears to be happening today and over the next few days, I think that's actually, my hope is that can actually be a good thing for the country going forward.
I was reading this morning that I think so far, I think this is according to Open Secrets, that $16.7 billion, that's with a B, dollars spent on state and federal races. I believe the most expensive midterm ever. And I think a lot of it ended up on TV. I don't know how much of wall-to-wall ads you saw, Jesse Wegman, but should we be concerned about that much of money being thrown at all these races?
I mean, of course. I'm not going to claim that I don't even know how much of that money actually achieved its purpose, right? I know that in New York, you know, Ron Lauder, the cosmetics magnate, put tens of millions of dollars behind Lee Zeldin and wound up with nothing. I remember Sheldon Adelson kind of struck out completely, spending hundreds of millions of dollars a few years ago. I'm sure some of these races, Peter Thiel, you know, bucked up J.D. Vance, and that paid off. Yes, the bottom line is outside money, and certainly outside money in these volumes, is not good for democracy. Thank the Supreme Court and Citizens United for some of that. And that's something else I'd like to just point out, which is the Supreme Court's role in this election is a really important one to not forget about. I think gerrymandering, obviously, is such a big part of the story of what has been happening over the last 10 years, but especially last night. I think, you know, the assuming the Republicans hold their lead in the House, and let's say they end up with a 10 to 15 seat margin, much smaller than expected, but still, you know, 10 to 15 seat margins, bigger than what Democrats have had over the last 2 years. That is going to be almost entirely due to gerrymandering, right? To the redrawing of political districts in ways that benefit the party in power without regard to how the voters cast their ballots. That is a perversion and a corrosion of representative democracy. Those of us who are deeply upset by it have been yelling at the Supreme Court for years to set standards to fix that, or to at least outlaw the most egregious gerrymanders, which we see right now in places like North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, even in Pennsylvania. And in 2019, they refused to do it. They said, this is not our problem. They washed their hands of it. They said, leave it up to the political process. Of course, it's the very political process that is being distorted. So they have, thrown us to the wolves and said, you know, fend for yourselves. I think it was a huge abdication of responsibility on the part of the Supreme Court. I think it is responsible for a Republican-led House, if that's what we end up with over the next 2 years. And I think it will continue to warp our democracy until some blocks are put into place. And, you know, you look even at, you know, the way this plays out in Ohio. Republicans drew these extremely gerrymandered districts. The state Supreme Court said, you can't have these districts. They violate our state constitution. And the Republicans said, you know, tough luck. And they just went ahead with it. They literally rejected, they flouted the rule of the state Supreme Court, and nobody was there to stop them. Meanwhile, in New York, the same thing happened with Democrats. Democrats tried to gerrymander their districts. The New York State Supreme Court said, you can't do that. Democrats respected the ruling in that case. And those two states alone might be sufficient to determine the outcome of the control of the House.
And only underscoring the importance of these statewide and local elections, because that's where the maps are drawn.
Absolutely. I mean, you're looking at state lawmakers who, you know, are closer to their voters, who are, you know, in theory supposed to be the ones who are most representative of them. And yet when you draw districts like this, you know, especially in places like Wisconsin, where they've had districts in the last 10 years where, a majority of votes in the state could go to Democratic candidates, and yet Republicans in the state legislature could have a super majority of seats. I mean, it's such a distortion of representative democracy, and for that reason, it's just so dangerous.
Do you think we live in two Americas?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, in some ways, yes. In some ways, you know, the splintering of both, you know, traditional sources of media and where people live, the geographic sorting that we've been watching play out. Yes, absolutely. I think people are increasingly choosing ideological and epistemological bubbles to live within. They only consort with people of like mind. They aren't forced to consider the views and the lives of people outside of their small circles. Yes, I think these are really profound problems for any democracy, and certainly for American democracy going forward. At the same time, I think what we've just been talking about for the last 20 minutes is a really remarkable coming together of voters from across the political spectrum, to reaffirm some very basic American values about democracy, about majority rule, about the rule of law. And so that in that sense, I feel like I'm not going to, you know, adopt some sort of Pollyannish language about one America, but I do think that is a good sign for the health of the country that people can come together and basically just reaffirm that, you know, when one party wins more votes than the other, that party wins the election.
Here's an email from Richard who says, talking about you, Jesse, says your guest is wildly optimistic about representative democracy. And then he goes on to say the full-on white grievance voter suppression party is still wedded to that.
I'm that's the first time I've ever been told that I am wildly optimistic about representative democracy. I'm deeply concerned. I've been deeply concerned for years. I've only grown more concerned since January 6th, 2021, when Donald Trump incited the insurrection at the Capitol. You know, I thought in some ways that the fever would break after that. Of course, things only appeared to get worse. No, I absolutely agree with your reader that grievance politics, cultural and racial revanchism is a huge threat going forward. I'm not prepared to just throw in the towel and to say, oh, well, you know, move to Canada or whatever it is that, you know, liberals usually say when they get fed up with American politics. I think, you know, right now, this is our country. We have to fight for it. And I think you saw that happen last night. You saw a new generation of voters coming out, voting overwhelmingly for Democrats. But I also think, as I heard in a quote from there was a clip that you played right before I came on from a voter, a Republican registered voter in a diner in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, actually one of our reporters.
Said,
yeah. Yep, yep.
Or one of your reporters reported this, right? I'm sorry. That the voter said, you know, I'm a registered Republican, but I'm voting for Josh Shapiro and for John Fetterman because of the insanity. You know, I don't want, you know, I want to get rid of this insane part of our politics. And I think what that's referring to is this election denialism and sort of violent, the sort of lean toward violence, which is very real and very serious and I think very dangerous going forward. I don't think that's changed. But I do hold out some hope that you saw last night and today and over the next few days a broad national pushback against those trends.
Let me just read a quick comment from Phyllis who says, don't give your listeners the incorrect impression that the next election in Pennsylvania is 2024. Obviously, next year, 2023, we have a mayor's race here in Philadelphia and some other races as well. Jesse, we're almost out of time here. And I put this actually to our two reporters and they said, yeah, let's get rid of the pundits. in that there was a lot of sort of hang-wringing and I think, you know, wrong predictions about what was going to happen in the midterms. Do you have a position on that?
Look, I mean, polls.
Polls, put
punditry aside for a moment. I mean, polls have been useful, but they've also obviously had some real issues for many election cycles now. And pollsters, I think, are trying. Most good faith pollsters are doing their best and are having a hard time with a rapidly changing society and media ecosystem. But, you know, I would prefer that we talk less about who might win, who might lose, and the sort of standard horse race politics, and talk more about the actual policies of the two parties and how American voters are affected by them and how voters in local areas are affected by them. I think that's what voters care about. They care about, I mean, it's easy to always watch the horse race part of it. That's kind of like just engaging on a popcorn level. But really, people do care about democracy. They care about reproductive rights. They care about immigration. They care about the economy. They care about crime. And these are the things that we should be talking about in terms of what parties will deliver on those issues. And when you do that, I think you get better and more accurate results. And I think you get politicians who are more likely to respond to what the voters have demanded. So I think it's a positive feedback loop to the extent that we in the media can talk more about the actual policies and less about who wins and who loses.
Well, Jesse Wegman, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, he's on the editorial board of the New York Times, wrote a book called Let the People Pick the President. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.